Great.
We're actually recording.
Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hopefully you edit this stuff out.
What's surprising to me is that both you and Lauren, postdocs in my lab, happen to do research in schizophrenia for your graduate work.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There's a pretty strong overlap between some of the mechanisms and the way we study drugs of abuse and schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders.
Okay.
So we both have very similar interests that led us kind of to the same path.
Okay. I had her last week. Now this week it's your turn, Katie.
My turn.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing your graduate work.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Your paper came out in 2024, I think in July of 2024. The title is Increased Regional Activity of a Pro-Autophagy Pathway and Schizophrenia as a Contributor to Sex Differences in the Disease Pathology. The paper was published in Cell Reports Medicine. You are the first author. The PI on the paper is Michael Cahill.
That's correct, yeah. And then the second author on the paper is Amanda Vanderplow, and I just want to give her a shout out because she did a lot of this work as well. She kind of started this project while we were both in grad school together, and I finished it. So, yeah, she did a lot of this work as well.
All right. Way to go, Amanda. Thank you so much for your contribution.
Yeah. But yeah, we can definitely start by talking about schizophrenia and the cognitive symptoms of schizophrenia, because those are kind of often overlooked. Most people focus on the psychotic symptoms, which we call positive symptoms, or the negative symptoms. But cognitive symptoms are often what kind of really impairs people's day-to-day life, and as well as kind of creates a lot of significant health cost and societal burden. So when we say cognitive symptoms, we mean executive functioning. So planning, organizing, working memory. And a lot of that is thought to be mediated by a brain region called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And so one of the really consistent pathological hallmarks of schizophrenia is that there's a reduction in dendritic spines and as well as arborization and soma size in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex in pyramidal neurons specifically. So this is really thought to contribute to the hypofunctioning of this brain region during cognitive processing.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm sure during the various points in this journal club, you will tell us more about all those sophisticated words that you use to describe schizophrenia and the cognitive deficits that come along with it. Okay. Where shall we begin? I think the paper is on autophagy.
Yeah. So the reason that we kind of started looking down this route is there were some recent studies that identified an emerging role for autophagy in controlling the stability of dendritic spines. And I don't think I mentioned, but dendritic spines are sort of these small protrusions from the dendrite, and they form the postsynaptic part of most of the excitatory synapses in your brain. And there was also some genome-wide association studies and some genome-wide studies that showed that the genes involved in autophagy were upregulated in specifically schizophrenia. So this sort of led us to really want to know and be interested in determining whether changes in these autophagy-related pathways might be contributing to some of the pathophysiology of schizophrenia. And I think that's kind of where we start with, like, the first figure is we got patient samples from human patients with either schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or healthy controls. And then we were able to probe these samples, which were brain homogenates from the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, four different proteins involved in autophagy and also markers of their activity. So maybe we could talk about that next.
Okay. All right. Katie, what's autophagy?
Well, autophagy is kind of like the cell cleanup mechanism. So it is how we recycle and remove proteins and organelles. So I like to think about it as if you were living in your house and you never did any cleaning ever, and you never threw away your trash, and it just started piling up and piling up. And suddenly you go to cook, but your stove is covered in trash, and it just makes it really hard to function. And so same with if you did too much cleaning, right? And suddenly you're throwing away the stove because you need to clean everything up, and then you still can't cook. It's still hard to cook, right? So the autophagy pathway is a way to maintain cell homeostasis, or kind of like the normal functioning of cells. And so all cells have this kind of cleanup process, and neurons specifically, it's super important, right? Because if our neurons in our brain can't function properly, then it's going to affect all sorts of things, including cognition. And so that is sort of the idea here, is we're looking at how problems with autophagy pathways might lead to cognitive deficits to cause disorder. And so a ton of different disorders have been hypothesized to have dysregulated autophagy mechanisms, and schizophrenia is one of them.
Okay. I will share my own experience with autophagy in popular science. There was a time where I was plugged into this part of the internet where people fasted for hours and deprived themselves of nutrients to get into the state of autophagy. And that's supposed to repair their cells and recycle the amino acids, recycle all the proteins that have already existed, and at the same time clean out all the proteins that have perhaps degraded and are no longer required. Mm-hmm. But here in your paper, it's actually in the first paragraph, and what really caught my attention is in neurite processes. So this in the axons and dendrites of nerve cells, we do not require nutrient deprivation to get into autophagy. The process still continues without any nutrient deprivation, and it doesn't need to be in bulk. It could be very specific. It could be very systematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of the difference between the autophagy that we're seeing in neurons, and specifically in the processes of neurons versus the cell body, is that it does seem to be what's called selective autophagy. There's lots of different types of autophagy. They kind of group them into bulk and selective. Mitophagy is one of the example. There's all kinds of different types of autophagy for different types of cleanup, right? And so we're still learning about the autophagy processes in neurons, but in specifically the distal dendrites, the dendritic spines, the axons, the smaller parts, which do seem to be more compartmentalized in general with function. And thus, it makes sense that we see more compartmentalized autophagy, right? More selective, more specific. And the complexities of the autophagy pathway and how it's regulated are a good example of how complex it is, right? And how our bodies are able to alter activity of this pathway very selectively for different reasons, different types of cleanup, different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll mention here synaptic pruning. I do not know if autophagy is the right word to use in this context, but what happens is some of the proteins at the synapses are relocated and recovered, so that we can form the nerve-to-nerve connections that we actually require, and not all nerves are connected.
Yeah, so maybe we should back up. Dendritic spines are kind of like small protrusions off the dendrites, and they form the postsynaptic part of pretty much most of the excitatory synaptic connections in your brain. And so really it's just a place of connection between two neurons where communication happens, and they sort of look like little mushrooms. And that allows for compartmentalization of signaling between neurons. So it's a way, we think, to have more selective communication, have more compartmentalized functions of these different processes along the same cell. And that way, the same cell can be regulated differently. And so when we think about pruning, what happens in that process is in development, you go through a process of increased number of dendritic spines. So as you develop, you get more and more dendritic spines. Eventually in late adolescence, early adulthood, you reach this peak, and then you will start pruning away the spines that you don't need. Because having too many spines is also detrimental, just as having too few. And so maybe that's a good segue then into the reason we're looking at this in schizophrenia is because schizophrenia has a lot of cognitive deficits, and they're not typically thought of as, you know, most people think of the psychotic symptoms as being very prominent. But the cognitive symptoms in schizophrenia are really what determine if an individual is able to successfully reenter into society, able to successfully kind of incorporate into their life, right? And it's really important. And it's actually one of the more detrimental aspects that's harder to live with. And so, unfortunately, there's no treatment options for that. There's treatment options for the psychosis. You know, they work for some people. There's some issues there too, but there's no treatment options at all for cognitive deficits.
Well, in this journal club, you're going to tell us about different protein complexes that are involved in the autophagy process. So could we introduce some of those proteins? Because I know it will be relevant as you describe what you have in figures 1 and 2 of this paper.
Yeah. So autophagy kind of starts with the formation of this double membrane phagophore, and that eventually encircles proteins and organelles to be degraded and get sealed, and then it forms what we call an autophagosome. And so the facilitation of the autophagosome assembly is kind of coordinated by the actions of two different complexes. One of them is the ULK1 complex, and the other is the PI3K3 complex. I don't know who names these things, but
and for listeners, you do not have to know what these exact protein names are. Just
there are two
along.
Complexes. Yeah. Yep, that's all you need to know.
Yep.
But basically, our interest, as you'll see, because of what we found in Figure One, really is on one of these complexes, because we focus on Beclin-1, which is a kind of director, I would say, or a good way to put that, for the PI3K3 complex. Basically, it can be phosphorylated. Beclin can be phosphorylated at a few different residues, and that phosphorylation kind of dictates the status of the activation of this complex, which then can initiate autophagy.
Okay.
So Beclin-1 sort of is the regulator, master regulator of whether or not this complex gets activated, and then that helps to determine whether or not autophagy happens.
Okay, so Beclin-1 is the protagonist in this story, correct?
Yes,
okay.
That's correct.
Gotcha, all right. You've done a lot of Western blots for this project. I can see it throughout the paper.
Yeah.
And as a neuroscientist now, it's very hard to glean a lot of information from Western blots themselves. But could you perhaps summarize what you found out from the human data that you have in figures 1 and 2?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Western blots are just a way to look at protein expression, and because of the nature of the method, we can get a quantitative value from that. So we can also look at phosphoproteins, and phosphorylation is, it's kind of like a way to turn on and off the activation or deactivate different proteins. Mm-hmm. Different phosphorylation sites on different proteins can be activated by other proteins, basically.
Gotcha.
It's how they communicate with each other, how they talk to each other, how they regulate each other.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first figure of this data, it basically is a bunch of Western plots, because we did, basically we probed these human samples for their protein expression of a bunch of different proteins that are involved in the autophagy pathway. So some of those make up these complexes. Some of them are, actually all of them that we looked at are important for, they are phosphorylated in order to activate these protein complexes and then initiate autophagy. So the important kind of first step we looked at was this phosphorylation site on AMPK, which is required for the basically initiation of all of the downstream processes for autophagy. So the activation of this phosphorylation site on AMPK leads to the activation of autophagy. So we found that we looked at, like I said, patients with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and then compared those to our healthy controls. And we found that there was an increase in the expression of this phosphorylation site on AMPK, but that was very specific. It was only in females with schizophrenia. So we didn't find that in the bipolar disorder subjects or in males. And that was very interesting. And so we kind of kept looking downstream, and we didn't really find any changes in any other pathway except the Becklin pathway. So this is a phosphorylation site on Becklin that is phosphorylated by AMPK. And like I said, that leads to the initiation of autophagy typically. And again, this was only in females with schizophrenia. So we're starting to see that this particular pathway is maybe upregulated. Hmm. And it's very specific to schizophrenia patients and females. Sorry, females with schizophrenia.
Got it. Okay. So there's a sex-specific effect that you observe here.
Yeah.
You only see it in female schizophrenia patients.
Mm-hmm. It was also brain region specific. So we looked at the orbital frontal cortex as well and found none of the same changes. So it was very specific to the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier, is really highly involved in cognition.
Okay. And for listeners here, Katie's work in this paper uses a reverse translational approach where she looked at human data and then took that human data to design mouse experiments and test different hypotheses. And the major goal, I would say, of biomedical research is you would observe something in humans that you take into an animal model, you study it, and then bring back solutions to humans. I think that the way I picture biomedical research is in such a manner. And that's what you're doing in this paper. So could you tell me how you use these results to translate the human data into a mouse model?
Yeah, so having human samples is really cool, but like you said, that can only tell us so much. We can see that there, you know, is an upregulation in this pathway, but what does that mean? What does the upregulation do? Is it causing something? Is it not causal? We don't know. And so we have to manipulate those pathways in the brain to be able to determine that. And we use mouse models for that. So we used viral mediated gene transfer, which is a method in which you use a virus and you specifically design it and manipulate it to express what you want it to express. So we designed basically a constitutively active Becklin construct. So this is mimicking the same exact changes we saw in the human samples. So this phosphorylation site by AMPK is basically constitutively phosphorylated. So it's we changed it for an aspartic acid and it makes it always active. So
just to reiterate, you created a mutated version of the protein where it's always active. It doesn't need to be activated by the other protein complex, which is the AMPK.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
Yep. And so then we can see what having, so in the human samples, there was more of this activity. And so we're basically mimicking that. We're trying to cause more of this activity. And the reason we use a viral approach is because we can put that directly into the brain region of interest. So because we only saw this in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, we wanted to be able to look at this only in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And so mice don't have a DLPFC. And so the homologue to that in mice is the medial prefrontal cortex. So here we infuse the virus into the medial prefrontal cortex of mice, and then we can observe what happens to them and study different questions.
Got it. And just to clarify, you used wild type mice. So these are not mice with schizophrenia phenotypes.
No.
These are just wild type healthy mice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yep.
So what did you observe when you injected the mutant version of Becklin 1 into the medial prefrontal cortex of wild type mice?
Yeah. So first, we just wanted to see what this did to autophagy. So we did look at one measure of autophagy. There's a lot of different ways to look at autophagy. It's not super easy to measure in the brain. We did find that in one measure of autophagy, that there was an increase in autophagy-related activity after injection of this virus, but it was, again, only in females. So that was interesting and also kind of fit with our data. But there's something specific about this being, again, in females.
Got it. And for those following along with the paper, this is in figure 3. You injected that human simplex virus that has the Becklin construct into it. And you measured for a light chain 3B, which you used as a marker for autophagy.
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you see this increase only in female mice.
Yes.
So this kind of strengthens the human observation that we made in figures 1 and 2. So this autophagy related schizophrenia phenotype is sex specific.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it fits with that pattern so far. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And, you've seen this sex-specific increase in autophagy when you injected female mice with that mutant version of Becklin 1. And from what I see in the paper, there happens to be some differences in dendritic spine morphology as well. And that's what you report in figure 4. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So this is kind of where things get cool, because we looked at dendritic spine morphology, like you said, and we found that there was an overall increase, which was very surprising to us, in total dendritic spine density, again, only in females. So this fits with the theme of cognition, right? So dendritic spines are very important for cognition, and specifically in this brain region. And we know in schizophrenia subjects that there is a reduction, typically, in dendritic spines in this brain region. So us seeing an increase in spines driven by this increase in Becklin was really interesting. And we specifically found that there was an increase in thin dendritic spines. They're typically classified into a couple of different categories, thin, mushroom, stubby being kind of the main three.
Mm-hmm.
Thin spines are more transient spines. They're less stable. They're considered kind of like learning spines. They're more related to that kind of working memory process, that whereas mushroom spines are thought to be more related to longer term stability.
Okay.
In cognitive processing.
Okay. Could we make the case that maybe these thin spines are sort of young and the mushroom ones are more mature, or is that a—
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
It's a little more complicated, but I think that's a very good way to think about it.
Got it.
That's like easy, yeah.
Okay. Now the next question comes, which is, what are the behavioral implications of this change in the morphology of the dendritic spines?
Yeah, so we did 2 cognitive tests on these mice, and one of them is called object in place. So this is essentially both tests take advantage of the fact that mice like to explore novel environments, novel things. And so we can take advantage of that by basically testing different types of memory. So this is a test of associative memory. And what it does is we put the mice into a box with 4 objects, and they get to explore the objects, and then we change the location of 2 of those objects. We give the mice kind of time away from the objects, and then we put them back in the box and see if they can recognize which object has been changed. And we do this by measuring how much time they spend exploring the objects. So what we tend to see is there's kind of equal amount of time spent exploring those objects that didn't change, but the the object that did change positions, those objects are explored a lot more because they're like, oh, this is different. This is new. And so we did that in our mice that had the Becklin overexpression, or we did that in our mice that received our constitutively active Becklin, and found that only in females there was an increase in their ability to perform this task. So they were able to recognize those swapped objects more easily than male mice. And that tracks really well with our spine data. So our spine data is that there's an increased amount of dendritic spines in females. And this is also leading to an increase in cognitive ability in females. And then we did a second test that is called the Y-maze spontaneous alternation task. And this is a test of spatial working memory. And so this is basically a Y-shaped maze. And when you put the mouse into the maze, it's going to want to explore the areas of the maze it hasn't explored very recently. So let's say you put the mouse into arm A, it's going to go into arm B, go explore arm B. It's going to come out of arm B and be like, huh, well, I was just in arm A. I'm going to go to arm C. I haven't been there yet. Mm-hmm. It's going to come out of arm C and be like, well, I was just in arm B. Let me go to A, which basically creates this kind of cyclical, what we call alternation pattern. And so the mice, when they start to, you know, re-enter an arm that they've just explored, it's an indication that their spatial working memory might be not as strong, or there might be deficits in that spatial working memory. And so what we found is that in addition to the increased ability to perform the object in place task, they also had this increased ability to perform the Y-maze task, so potentially suggesting an increase in spatial working memory.
All right. And I think that completes all the results in the study, but if we were to tie it together, what is it exactly that we learned from this study?
Yeah, so this is kind of a really interesting first step. We were really surprised, honestly. Like when we first started looking at this and we saw an increase in autophagy-related activity, autophagy can be good, it can be bad. Too much autophagy, like I said, can be bad, and too little autophagy can be bad, right? And so when we first started looking at modeling our human findings in mice, we were really surprised that we found that it was actually pro-cognitive, right? This is actually helping the cognitive deficits, or not deficits, these are wild-type mice, but helping cognition.
Okay.
And it is very specific to females, which is really fascinating. And we need to do a lot more work to figure out what the mechanism of that is and why. But it's just a really cool first step in maybe a potential treatment option for patients with schizophrenia to treat these cognitive deficits. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done, but it's kind of exciting. And it's cool that it's sex specific and that really, really held up the whole study. It really is very specific. So there's a lot more cool research to be done here, but it has a lot of potential to help people.
All right. Thank you so much, Key. I know there's a bigger paper coming out soon, and it would show your a lot of your thesis work from graduate school.
Yeah, that's correct. We should have that out kind of soon, yeah.
And I hope when it's out, you'll come back to the Journal Club and share it with my listeners.
I'd love to.
All right. Thank you so much, Katie. I will, as always, I'll add a PubMed link to the paper and the lab webpage of Michael Cahill at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Correct, yeah.
And next week, I'll be back with another paper. And until next time, ciao.